is the third and final week of the gravitational physics course. And this week we're kind of going to be covering more advanced topics, if you like. Not that I want to imply that what we've been doing beforehand is necessarily basic, but nonetheless, this week we're kind of sort of flying off a little bit more into the, you know, towards the boundaries, at least, of the research. So what I want to cover this week is extra dimensions, because that's quite an important part of theoretical gravity. So today, tomorrow, and maybe a bit of Wednesday, the theme that we're going to be around is extra dimensions. And then hopefully we'll get to cover a bit more on extended thermodynamics of black holes and also non-perturbative processes in quantum processes in gravity. So today I want to talk about Kaluza-Klein theory, because I think that's sort of one of these important topics in advanced gravity that we kind of come across before we get too far in our reading around. So Kaluza-Klein theory actually is quite old, the idea. It's now a century or so old, and it wasn't initially put forward as a means of thinking about, or necessarily thinking about, the fact that, you know, gravity had extra dimensions. It was more along the lines of a philosophy of unification. So now I'm going to get my K's mixed up, whether it was Kaluza or Klein. I think it was Kaluza. Please, someone correct me if I'm wrong. Who came up with the notion of looking at gravity with one extra dimension and finding that the dynamics of gravity in that extra dimension gave us an effective gauge field in four dimensions. And Klein kind of came up with an idea about stabilization, or how to avoid something that was unwanted in terms of that field degree of freedom. So Einstein, I mean, was initially quite resistant to this notion. So the paper was delayed for a few years. So, I mean, these days, I can only imagine the, you know, the sort of outrage of the author if a paper got delayed. Even, I mean, even a few months, people start getting a little bit agitated. So, different times. Okay, so could space-time have more than four dimensions? I mean, certainly from a theoretical perspective, we should at least consider gravity in different numbers of dimensions to try and see what insight it gives us into gravity in four dimensions. So we should be exploring this theoretically, but on the other hand, we know the world around us looks four-dimensional. Well, really looks three-dimensional if we're going to be nitpicky, but of course we have our experience of time. So if we have extra dimensions, we must find a mechanism by which they are not visible to us, where we're also going to have to think about what we mean by visible. And so the usual, the Kaluza-Klein example, and the usual example we might think of this, is a hose pipe. So a hose pipe, if we're actually holding on to it, we can see is obviously three-dimensional. And if we try and bend it a bit, well, sort of the way it resists the local physics is definitely three spatial dimensional. However, if we're looking at a hose pipe from far away, it looks linear. And its general behavior is going to be quite well approximated by a line or curve rather than some three-dimensional object. We're kind of, you know, expending effort that maybe we shouldn't be expending if we start trying to keep it as being a three-dimensional object. So it's a similar idea with Kaluza-Klein theory. So I'm going to do the canonical Kaluza-Klein with one extra dimension. The idea there is we're going to add an extra dimension, but it's going to be a little circle. And our philosophy is going to be that we're not going to waste time by doing full five-dimensional gravity. We're going to look at what the effective degrees of freedom are at our four-dimensional large scale. So let me get some of those words down. So this is kind of the idea. We've got a five-dimensional metric, which, and I'm only putting it in inverted commas because I just want to, I mean, we'll do it properly in a moment, but the idea is that we've got some four-dimensional metric, which is the large-scale metric that we see, but then we have an extra circle, degree of freedom, where we imagine this L is small. So that's the idea. And what do we mean by small, or why does this sort of achieve an effective four-dimensional theory? So if we consider some a field on this space-time, we might expect we should expand in Fourier modes of that theta. So if we expand in Fourier modes in our extra dimension, then if we look at, say this is a massless field, so the effect of those, of any dependence on theta, is to introduce what looks like an effective mass term proportional to 1 on L.
Sorry, It seems that your Fourier mode 2 pi I theta divided by L is root of.
Is what, sorry?
Sorry, I don't know why there's a
Yeah, so I looked at that, actually. I was looking at this and somehow I was, you see, I want L to be the size of the internal dimension. So theta, annoyingly, runs from 0 to 1 here. I mean, the 2 pi's are kind of irrelevant, but I added the 2 pi I over L times theta so that when theta goes, you're right, it's 2 pi I theta. Thank you. What comes from not writing down what's written in front of you. That now works if theta goes from 0 to 1.
Period of theta is arrow of 2 pi.
Is 1.
Oh, it's 1. Okay.
So the length of the internal dimension is 1. So just in case there's... This is one of these cases where you want to set 2 pi to 1, but whatever. Okay, so here, that's now, I think, right. The purpose of this, nonetheless, was simply to illustrate that if you look at the effective four-dimensional physics that corresponds to this five-dimensional geometry, then any dependence on the extra dimension gives you a mass. So excitations that have an effective mass. So if L is small, this effective mass is large. And so there's this sort of enormous mass gap between things that are happening in four dimensions and things that depend on the fifth dimension. So our low energy physics does not depend on the extra dimension. So from our geometrical perspective or language, if we're having things that are independent of some direction or coordinate, what this means is that d by d, I'm going to change it to chi from theta to phi. Never have used theta. Okay, so what we're saying is that all of our physics is independent of this extra dimension. So from our perspective, that means we have a killing vector d by d chi. So once we have a killing vector, we then have a set of constraints on our metric. So we can ask, how do we decompose our metric? So our g is independent of this fifth dimension. So I can write it in the form if I just sort of imagine a block diagonal, my metric has this form, but none of the functions depend on the chi, the fifth coordinate. So I want to find a convenient way of encoding those degrees of freedom. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, first of all, I say that g phi phi, that's just a scalar. So I'm going to call that e to the 2 sigma. Then my g mu 5, that has 1 space-time index. So I'm going to encode that as a gauge, what looks like a gauge field A times this e to the 2 sigma. And the reason I do that is so I can complete the square. And here, my g mu nu, I'm representing as a g naught plus an a mu a nu. And the reason to package things in this way is so that dec g5 is e to the sigma dec g naught. So the determinant now is just I pick off the determinant of this and the determinant of this, which is just a number. So our five-dimensional metric has decomposed into four-dimensional fields, one of which is spin 2, gravity, or something that looks like gravity. This is a vector, and this is a scalar. So we have, or it looks like we could get a scalar tensor gravity, but we've also got this gauge field floating around, this vector field A. So everything just depends on the four-dimensional coordinates x mu. So what we're going to do is we're going to at least give an indicator of how we decompose our five-dimensional gravity into four-dimensional gravity. So I've suggestively called these tensor, vector, and scalar, but we need to know, is that actually how they behave from the four-dimensional perspective? So so our geometry, we assume that our five-dimensional geometry satisfies an Einstein action. So the five-dimensional geometry is going to behave as if we were in a five-dimensional Einstein space. But we need to know what that means for these different irreducible parts of our metric from a four-dimensional perspective. So we're going to use Cartan. So you can sort of see a little bit, at least, about what happens when you have off-diagonal terms. So our forms are going to be if we want an orthonormal basis, we have to take an orthonormal basis for G naught. And then our omega 5 is fairly clear. It's just e to the sigma times d chi plus a. So in order to get my connection one forms, I just have to take the exterior derivative. So if I look here, this is just like if I only had a four-dimensional space-time, this would just be the orthonormal basis for that four-dimensional space-time. And so I would get like if I just denoted that omega naught, this is what I would get, which is, of course, omega naught is just omega. Meanwhile, d omega 5 is a bit more involved. I've got a sigma comma a, omega a cross omega 5. Okay. So this is what I get for the d omega 5. I should decide, am I calling it five or chi? Let me call it chi. So there I've just written a mu dx mu just as a one form a. And so now you sort of see that something like electromagnetism might be creeping in here, because dA we would naturally write as the Maxwell stress tensor F. So here, I want to associate this thing with F. So if I want to peel off my one forms, notice that d omega chi is going to be minus theta chi hat a hat cross omega a hat. So that tells me that my theta chi a is just a derivative of sigma times omega chi plus this F term. But I have to be more careful when looking at the AB connection one forms, because this has two pieces. So in general, when you want to find the connection one forms, you have the Cartan structural equation, which is d omega a is minus theta a b omega b, where you sum over all possible b's, which is why we've put the chi hat in here. It's simply a set of simultaneous equations. So sure, the coefficients of one forms, but all you have there is a set of simultaneous equations. So when you have a block diagonal metric, it's very, very easy. You don't really notice that they're simultaneous equations because you just see straight out what the one forms are. When you have an off-diagonal metric, these sort of these pieces, if you like, from different subspaces start communicating, and so you actually do have to think about solving the simultaneous equation. So you see here, this theta a chi cross omega chi, if I cross this thing with omega chi, the first term drops out, but the second term doesn't. So what that means is, when I look to read off what my theta a b is, it has the obvious theta naught, which is the connection on the four-dimensional metric here, g naught, but I also have to add a compensating piece, proportional to the F, so that when I take theta AB cross omega B and subtract the theta A chi cross omega chi, this term is cancelled off to give me the theta naught. So we then take our thetas and go forward with calculating the Riemann tensor, or the curvature two forms. And I think David has made a handout, so you have all the details. The algebra is kind of quite long and involved, so I'm going to choose one of the components to work through so that you kind of see some of the details involved, but I won't do it all because it's quite the calculational slog. But we'll just at least see it so that you can see that even though this is now an example where you have to work harder with Cartan, it's still not, you know, it's only a little bit harder. It all comes out on one sheet of paper. So let's look at our chi, just as an example. So this will be our curvature two form that's got mixed components. And so what I have to do is I have to insert that theta chi A here and take the exterior derivative. So the first term in theta chi A is sigma A omega chi. So that, if I take D of that, so that's D of the first part of theta chi A. Then I have to take D of the second bit. So I'm going to get a sigma comma C . So that's taking D of e to the sigma. That's taking D of the FAB. And then finally, I have to take D of omega B. So now I've done D of theta chi A. So now I have to take theta chi B crossed with theta B A. So if I just look here, I can see the first piece, which is an omega chi, is going to give me a cross term with theta naught, but not with that, because it's omega chi cross omega chi. So that's the first cross term. And then for the rest, I've got a half e to the sigma f omega crossed with that, with both of these terms now. I get something from this one and something from this one. So that's the final bit of the computation. So you can see that if I just look through here and kind of try and pick out terms. So I've got, this is the cross term of chi A. Now remember, when we want to find the Ricci scalar, that is the trace of the Ricci tensor, and the Ricci tensor is the contraction of the Riemann tensor on the first and third indices. So if I have here this chi, ultimately anything, these cross terms, where are we? Anything that has two space-time indices does not end up contributing to my Ricci scalar. So if I, that's one of these, that's this one, chi B A. So this is a mixed term, okay. So the green pieces are the pieces that I actually am interested in. So when I collect everything together, I've just written it down, collecting everything together. You see that if we look at the sort of what we're going to get in our Riemann tensor, we get the bits that are going to contribute to Ricci. So you see here, I've written now here the connection one form. I've expanded it out as gamma contracted with an omega. So here you see this gamma turns that comma into a semicolon in terms of the components. So here I've got the second derivative of sigma plus two first order derivatives of sigma, and then I've got an FF term. And then the off sort of diagonal, the bits that we don't need, these are like d sigma times an F piece. And then here you see that these terms give you a covariant derivative of F. So, and ultimately these are kind of going to group together to give a sort of Jacobi type identity for F. So what we need is our chi A, So now I've flipped to this abstract index notation for convenience. These are just the AB components of the second order covariant derivative of sigma. So this is what contributes to our Ricci scalar. And then, a similar, you know, board's worth of computation will give you the other components of Ricci. So it's definitely more effort than the block diagonal examples that we've seen so far for Cartan, but it's still not so far, it's not an outrageously difficult calculation. So anything that you can put on one board is still fairly compact. So now, having got our Riemann, we find our Ricci, and therefore Ricci tensor, and therefore Ricci scalar. Okay. So with the components of the Riemann tensor, we simply contract on the first and third index. So our chi chi is simply the top line contracted on A and B. So that's fairly easy to see where that term comes from, the box sigma and grad sigma squared, an F squared piece. And then the RAB, we have to, first of all, take the top line because that's taking the contraction of the first and third index where they're the fifth coordinate chi. And then we have to trace the second expression across A and C. So you see that you get the R naught. So if there's curvature in that four-dimensional metric, it shows up here. And then everything else is just to do with F in that. So by the time you've contracted absolutely everything down to the Ricci scalar, you find that there are basically three parts to it. You've got the curvature of whatever that G naught was. You've got the sort of field strength of this cross term A. So this, you could also, you know, when we did the Gauss equation for the Gauss-Kodaczy formalism, we had that the n-dimensional Riemann was the lower dimensional Riemann was the higher dimensional Riemann projected down plus kk terms. And the extrinsic curvature was sort of like part of a connection. And it was due, the connection that was due to the fact that the embedding curved. So here we're getting the same sort of structure. We've got the curvature of the underlying four-dimensional manifold, and then we've got this piece that shows up in the connection. So normally connections are not physical, but in this sort of case, they're telling us something about either an embedding or a sort of cross term. And finally, we have something that is coming from the size of the internal dimension. So right back at the beginning, I'd given my internal dimension a fixed size of L, but of course, in general, the size of this internal dimension can vary, and it's sigma, the scalar field, e to the sigma, is telling you how big that internal dimension is. So if I look at what my five higher dimensional Einstein action is, so the root g, we chose our expression for the five-dimensional metric so that the determinant was straightforward. So root g5 goes to e to the sigma root g naught, and then our r5, we've just seen, is r naught. I can write my derivatives of sigma in the following form. So I'm grouping them together. I can write that box sigma plus grad sigma squared as a wave operator acting on e to the sigma. And so now you see that when the e to the sigma comes in, what I've got is the total derivative. So when I write out my five-dimensional action, I can see that this is just going to give me a boundary term, which in the sort of spirit of only being interested in bulk terms, I'm going to kind of ignore. I'm then going to do my integral over the chi direction. Well, I said that I'm allowing, in this case, my chi runs from naught to L. And so I get I simply end up with an action for my four-dimensional metric, G naught, and this cross term, the A field. So this looks like Einstein-Maxwell theory. So this was kind of what Kaluza had noticed, and if you impose that sigma was just naught, so that e to the sigma was one, then this would be exactly Einstein-Maxwell theory. However, we now have to sort of come at this with a notion of not just building a toy model. We want to sort of say, well, if this is really what's happening, we can't just fix sigma at a particular value without having a mechanism to fix sigma at a particular value. So, if we don't have a mechanism, we then have to say, well, what, you know, what is the consistent dynamical theory corresponding to this four-dimensional vector field theory? So what do we really have? This is reminiscent of that Brand-Sticky example. We've got some scalar multiplying the Ricci term in the Einstein-Hilbert action. So this looks like a sort of scalar tensor theory. So the final steps that we take in order to sort of write down our Kaluza-Klein degrees of freedom, we notice that G naught mu nu is not the canonical Einstein giving us the canonical Einstein-Hilbert term. So what we have to do is actually do a conformal transformation. So I think I mentioned this when I talked about Brand-Sticky gravity, but let's put a bit more flesh on that. So the idea here is that we say G naught mu nu is equal to omega squared of x G mu nu. So this is going to be our new metric. So a conformal transformation is one which preserves angles but scales distances. So we first meet conformal transformations in two dimensions where everything's kind of nice and easy and really, really well controlled. In four dimensions, there's a bit more complexity, but from the perspective of gravity, all we're doing is we're saying angles are the same. So remember how we take an angle. We define an angle between vectors by taking the dot product of the two vectors and then rescaling by the magnitudes of the vectors. So that's exactly the same here. And you notice that if you take the dot product of two vectors, that's just the metric G, that scales by omega squared. But then the norm of each vector, which is defined as sort of V dot V, with or G of VV, that also scales as omega. So our angle is left invariant by this transformation. So of course, with a Lorentzian metric, we're sort of, it's, you know, things can have plus or minus norms, so it's a little bit more, it's not, you know, not as totally straightforward as the standard dot product, but it's the same idea. So this is what a conformal transformation is in the sense of geometry and our metrics. So if I do this transformation, I can run through, turn the handle, calculate the new connection coefficients, because if you remember the expression for the Christoffels, it's simply G inverse and various derivatives of G. So each time you take a derivative of G, you pick up additional pieces that look like d omega. So you can do the calculation of the gammas, the Christoffels, and then you can input that into the calculation of Riemann. So if you were going to do normal coordinates, actually, then you would have this situation where there were no first-order derivatives of the metric. And so if you wanted to compute the new Riemann, you'd just be looking at d-gamma pieces. And the d-gamma pieces would give you the background Riemann pieces plus differentials of the omega. So you can see that you're going to get d sort of second-order derivatives of omega plus possibly first order derivatives of omega. So I leave this either as an exercise, or if David's been very kind, it's in your notes. And so you find that the Ricci scalar in four dimensions has this transformation. So in general dimensions, you get a different numerical coefficient and you pick up d omega pieces. So looking here, my root g naught r naught transforms to, well, root g goes to root g naught is omega to the fourth times root g. And then I've got an omega to the minus two r minus six omega inverse box omega. So when I look at the top board there, I see that my action has an e to the sigma times root g naught r naught. Here, I've got omega squared root g r. So this suggests that I set omega is e to the minus sigma on two, and then I get that expression for root g naught r naught. So now when I pop this in into my five-dimensional action, I see that this four-dimensional action with the conformally transformed metric is now in a sort of familiar Einstein form. When I input my new conformally transformed metric, I now get the Einstein action, minus r over 16 pi g, where my g4 is going to be g5 on L. And I get the f squared piece, but I now have, as a result of doing the conformal transformation, I now have a kinetic term for my scalar, and I've just rescaled sigma, repackaged it, if you like, into phi. So, actually, that doesn't quite work. Should be the other way around. Sorry. Sigma is phi on root 3. Get rid of the 3 there. So now I've repackaged the degrees of freedom of my theory into things that now have a familiar appearance. I've got the Einstein action, so that tells me that this G, my conformally transformed G, is behaving like normal gravity. I've got a what looks like a normal scalar field, phi, it has a canonical kinetic term. And the only thing where things are starting to look a little bit different is that I have, rather than just f squared, I have e to the some power of phi multiplying f squared. So this is the Kaluza-Klein theory. So just for completeness, I'll write down the metric so that you see how it now decomposes. So there's a few comments I want to make. Notice that G is renormalized. So our G4, which we could say was G Newton, is G5 over L. So if our little extra dimension does not curl up at the Planck scale, that means that we've now instituted a hierarchy between a higher dimensional gravitational constant and our four-dimensional gravitational constant. So this is kind of the reason why I don't like to set G equal to 1, because if you do, then you don't necessarily see that the gravitational constant can kind of change as you dimensionally reduce. So you can maybe, you sort of miss that things are going on there. And the other comment that I wanted to make is here I've done everything with one extra dimension because there's, you know, first of all, that was what Kaluza and Klein did, but also the sort of algebraic workload is enough. So you can sort of see how to do it, but it's sort of beginning to get to being more of a lengthy calculation. So what if you have more dimensions? So you can have arbitrary extra dimensions, 2, 4, 6. But now you have to think about what happens when you do the dimensional reduction. So we've already looked at block diagonal metrics with arbitrary sort of dimensions of the different components. So what happens So the obvious example might be compactifying with two extra dimensions on a two-sphere. So the two-sphere has internal curvature, and this is going to show up when you decompose the higher dimensional Ricci scalar. You're going to get, just like here, where we took the higher dimensional Ricci scalar and we got something that was the Ricci scalar of the four-dimensional manifold plus bits with A and sigma. If this is now a higher dimensional manifold, there will also be a term coming from the curvature of that manifold. And that's going to be multiplied by some power of e to the sigma. So you start getting Liouville-type potentials for your scalar, the overall size of the internal dimension. You also, if you have a, like the S2, if you have an algebra of Killing vectors, essentially what happens is here we had an A mu which corresponded to the Killing vector d by d chi. And what happens is you get a gauge field for each Killing vector. So if you have an algebra of Killing vectors, you've got an algebra of gauge fields. And what this does is it gives you non-abelian gauge fields in 4D. So your extra dimensional piece might look something like this. So that's the sort of idea. For each of the Killing vectors, you've got a partner gauge field. So the A there is the internal algebra index. So remember, we had our SO3 algebra of Killing vectors. So here, this is our SO3 algebra, for example, and then the I is the sort of expression of that Killing vector in the coordinate basis. So for example, if it was the two sphere, you would have the phi, you know, if this was the phi, I was equal to phi, you'd have d phi plus the phi component of each of these Killing vectors. So the three index would just be one, because that's d by d phi. And then for the other indices, it's whatever it is, the cos theta, cot, or what have you. Sorry, cos phi, cot, theta pieces. So that's how things change if you have more internal dimensions. Interestingly, when you have more internal dimensions, there's other things that can come into play. So for example, if you have a two-sphere, you can put a flux on your two-sphere, so you can give it like an F theta phi, and that ends up actually giving you a restoring force in terms of the size of the two sphere. So in general, if you have a lot of internal dimensions, you can start putting fluxes on the internal dimensions that can kind of stabilize some of the degrees of freedom. So it's as the more dimensions you add, the more color that you can get in your Kalitza-Klein compactification. And so when people first started exploring this towards the end of the 70s, they got very excited because they thought, wow, maybe geometry can give us our non-abelian gauge groups and we get unification. So it didn't quite work out that way, but it's still, you know, I think some of the more interesting stories in terms of compactifications down to four dimensions happen when you have lots of sort of extra dimensions and extra structure. So I better stop.